The Alaska Powerline Podcast is generously supported by Genpak. As a stocking electric utility distributor, Genpak has taken care of customers in the Pacific Northwest since 1965. With a strong customer focus and dedicated sales staff, they have built lasting relationships by providing quality products with value-added services. Now with a new Anchorage warehouse and a dedicated Alaska sales and support team, Genpak is ready to take care of their Alaska customers for years to come. Visit them at www.genpac.com for more information. Genpak, taking care of our customers since 1965. Welcome to Alaska Powerline, the podcast of Alaska Power Association, the statewide trade association for electric utilities in Alaska. On Alaska Powerline, we talk about issues facing Alaska's electric utilities, interview a wide range of guests, and demystify what it takes to provide power in the last frontier. Welcome back, everyone, to the Alaska Powerline podcast. I'm Michael Rovito, Deputy Director of Alaska Power Association, and we're excited today to be joined by Dustin Hires, the Vice President of Corporate Programs and the Program Manager for Decarbonization at Chugach Electric Association. Dustin, thanks for joining us today.
Well, of course. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I know you're really busy over there at Chugach, and so we're glad to have you on the call. Why don't you start off by telling us just exactly what you do over there at Chugach and what your background is?
Sure. I've worked for Chugach for about 21 years now, so it's been a little while in the cooperative space. But as most Alaskans want to know, do you know our state? Of course I do. I grew up here. We came to Nenana outside of Fairbanks back when I was a little kid, and I grew up in Homer and Glen Allen, so graduated high school at Glen Allen and went to the Merchant Marine Academy after that. Got the nomination from Frank Murkowski, so the senior. So I did all that, joined the Merchant Marine, went out to sea, went around the world, saw a lot of stuff, did a lot of things. Ended up in Hong Kong for about 4 years running a business on marine surveying. When I got tired of that, I came back home. I went to work for the oil and gas industry, did some time up on the North Slope at the Alpine Project at the time, before moving into the gas turbine world, gas turbine OEMs with companies like GE and Alstom Power and ABB Power Generation. kind of an exciting time before moving finally back home and taking this job and ending up in the power generation world for about 20 years, and then moved into this position to take over essentially a cross-cutting type of program approach that this traditional utility has never done before. So moving into a brand new world here, we're all having to cross-pollinate all of our different expertise for the first time and come up with solutions that are going to work for decarbonization.
Yeah, very neat. Thanks for that. And as somebody who has a healthy fear of the ocean, I'm glad that we got folks like you who are out there keeping things rolling in that realm. So Dustin, we have you on today to talk about regulating variable energy. And, for kind of like in the simple terms, variable energy is anything that isn't constantly running, solar, wind, something that's, up and down. And a lot of what we wanted to talk to you about is kind of balancing that out on the grid and what it takes to really integrate that sort of stuff. And so I think it's probably good to start off with just how sensitive the grid is in terms of balancing the frequency. Can you talk just real quick about what that means when somebody says like the frequency of the grid and balancing things on it?
It is one of the most critical fundamental issues that we're facing as utilities. In the past, we've had this relatively stable grid. And I say relatively because there are, issues and oscillations and things that we deal with and are having to take on as challenges. But when the load changes, we can generally respond to that. That's, we have multiple peaks per day and we have different times a year that are higher than others. But now we're looking at a world where the generation also changes outside of our control. And that's that variable energy that you're talking about. So variable energy comes in a couple of different flavors, one of which we like and one of which is the challenge. The one that we like is what we refer to as dispatchable. Things like hydro. This is a renewable energy source, but it's very dispatchable. We can tell it what to do and when. Things like tidal, even, are certainly things that we can't anticipate. So it becomes dispatchable. It's variable, but it's dispatchable. The ones that are not dispatchable are things like wind and solar, because it just shows up whenever the power's there.
Right.
And this is the big challenge of bringing on that variable source at some size, some quantity that we've never done before.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit with variable sources. I know there's, you know, all of APA's members are looking to diversify their generation, and there's, you know, big pushes from various places to increase the amount of renewables on the system. But there's a process that has to take place first, and we have to be ready for it. So if renewable energy can save so much money, why aren't we doing it right now? What are we doing in the short term to prepare for all this?
Well, absolutely. I'll start back in 2021. Chugach put out an RFP for renewable energy. We didn't really know what we were going to get. We suspected the prices were going to be a bit high, but we needed to identify what those prices were and what the possibilities were for these resources coming on. So when it comes to taking that information and saying, okay, we have a nice project here. We actually identified two projects that were relatively close to our avoided cost at the time. And of course, that's a little bit of a tricky wicket right there that we can talk about in a second. This concept of avoided cost and the regulations and how that gets calculated. But what we need to do when we get a proposal like this or a type of project like this is to go through a whole series of studies. One thing that is very important to know is that we are in a closed system. We are not connected to Canada or the lower 48 in any way. We have to depend on ourselves for everything that happens. Electricity is not forgiving. It is sub-second, almost light speed, and problems happen immediately. Right. So the studies that we do are in anticipation of that, trying to make sure that when we bring a system on, that we know how it's physically going to plug in. When we bring it on, we know how it's going to act on the grid. When we collect all those projects that have to happen as a result of that, then we have to figure out if we can afford it. We have to run the economics. So a lot of what's happened to date is really just this energy calculation where we say, hey, if we put on a bunch of renewables, we're going to save a bunch of gas. And that's true. That's absolutely a motivating force to get all this done. But it goes from the energy camp to the power camp. The power people are the people at the utilities that have to deal with that variable power in order to make it work on the grid. And that's what we're struggling with right now, is going through all of those studies to make sure we have a solution that absolutely works the first time and every time.
And I would imagine, I mean, this might be an obvious thing to say, but, you know, as a utility, I know the safety is obviously the number one priority, but next and right up there is reliability, correct? And so you can't just integrate these variable generation sources like wind and solar willy-nilly, because you need to make sure that grid is stable and that the power is there when the people need it.
Correct? Absolutely. Reliability is king. I mean, as you said, safety is a given. I mean, we don't do anything that's going to hurt people. Mm-hmm. But take reliability in context of safety. Here in the state, when the power goes out in the middle of the winter, that has a safety element for our community, not just for our cooperative workers and the people that run power plants and distribution and transmission systems.
Yeah, if you can, talk for just a second about the challenges. You know, you mentioned that the rail belt grid, so to speak, which runs from Homer up to the interior and the Fairbanks North Pole area, it's not connected to any other system. It's not connected to another country or another state. And so in that situation, what does that mean in practice for the way that Chugach, for instance, might think about their power generation or their day-to-day operations as compared to a utility in the lower 48 that's connected to a massive grid system?
Sure. No, it's a really good question. We operate the system at what we call 60 hertz. Mm-hmm. That means it has to operate at a certain, I'll call it speed, all the time. When we deviate from that, things start happening that are not good on the grid. including up to and including large generators, synchronous generators, we call them, the big power plants that we have, those can actually trip offline to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. So we have to maintain frequency within a certain range in order to maintain the operation of the grid. The problem for us is that our grid is very small, and we can't compare ourselves necessarily to the lower 48, where it takes on the order of 2,500 megawatts to push that frequency around 0.1 hertz. For us, it's more on the range of 8 to 16. Mm. So when we start talking about bringing on very large amounts of renewable energy, which is variable energy, which we or variable power, I'm sorry, that we can't control, I hope you can see the relationship there between 8 to 16. And now we're talking about bringing on 50, 100, 150 megawatts of variable power. We have to make sure we have a very good solution for that right now before we even start.
Yeah, it seems like the margin for error is so much smaller in the here in Alaska than it is on this like the system of low 48. And so when you need the balance and kind of manage that variable energy. But before we get to that, let's talk about something else that's more important. Not more important, but extremely important. I think this is all important, but kind of step-wise. So new wind and solar resources that we've heard about in the news, you know, there's been a lot of studies, there's a lot of folks working toward these goals. They require the system to be upgraded. And this has been in the news lately. There's been, a lot of talk about what's needed to upgrade the grid in the rail belt to take on some of these variable energy source, variable power sources. My apologies. Can you talk a little bit about what that is, what those upgrades are? Like, what do we need to do? What sort of upgrades do we need to accomplish in order to accommodate, these variable sources?
Yes, absolutely. The type of projects that we need to bring on, they come in two categories. One is the things that are high, we call it TRL, or technical readiness level. These are the things that are commercial. These are the things we can buy right now, the projects that we can pursue right now. There's also another category out there that people are very excited about. It's in the realm of long-duration energy storage. There's a lot of discussion on this. Chugach Electric and myself particularly were nominated as the industry advisor for Sandia National Labs National Consortium on commercializing long-duration energy storage. Yeah. I mean, we need to pay attention to that, but we can't let it slow us down. We have goals that have to be met in the short term, which means we have to focus on that high TRL. So those projects come in the form of short duration energy storage, which is like lithium ion batteries. They're very fast acting. They're very good tools. They're also very expensive. Mm-hmm. So you got that. And the fact that what we're trying to do is use our thermal power plants to also do what we call, quote unquote, follow the wind or solar. We cannot do that currently because the gas flows on the gas system are restricted to a point where we have to tell the gas company a day ahead, hour by hour, what we're going to use and keep that margin within about 10%. So if we don't do that, it messes up the fuel gas supply system and we get fined. So the other version of the regulation projects that we're pursuing is an above ground gas storage facility that will allow us to buffer that and maintain the flows coming in off the fields that are right here in the Cook Inlet. Mm-hmm. And still, maintain our contractual requirements while allowing the thermal power plants to run up and down and contribute to this solution. So again, BESS and gas storage are the two big things happening right now. In the future, we're going to be talking about long duration energy storage. Golden Valley, for instance, is looking at this Westinghouse solution called pumped thermal energy storage. It's a great big storage device that moves relatively slow and it has certain limitations. But that's okay. It's fit for purpose for a different type of arrangement that is going to be very useful to us in the future.
Yeah, you said something in there that struck me. And you talked about following the load. And I wonder if you could tell the listeners a little bit about what that means in terms of, you know, you have wind and solar, for instance, which you mentioned. Sometimes the sun's not always shining or maybe the sun is shining, then some clouds come in or a storm rolls in or the wind's not always blowing. So as a as an electric utility, what does it take, technically speaking, to make sure that when the those renewable sources dip or you know the power that's coming from them dips, how do you make up the gap? Like, what do you do to make sure that the power that we are using, consumers, we don't notice a difference at all when that solar wind goes down? What happens in the background?
I can use Fire Island, what we're doing right now with our one wind resource that Chugach has. We do what we call reg up. It's regulation up or regulation down, depending on which way the existing resources are responding to that variable generation source. So, for instance, if there's no wind, we have to fill that gap of what was dispatched or expected for that variable source. So right now we're using hydro in order to fill that gap. When the wind doesn't blow, the hydro picks up, it gets dispatched up and fills that gap. And when the wind picks up, that hydro backs off. Well, we need to do that on a much, much larger scale now. And we don't have enough hydro to actually do that, which is why we need these other types of projects to start filling in the gap for the reg up and the reg down purposes in order to stabilize that that generation source.
So that's where those batteries come in that you're talking about, perhaps, where you could, if you have excess power coming from your renewable sources, for instance, maybe you stock some of that away in the battery, and then when the renewables start producing less, you can pull some of that out of the battery. Is that right?
That's the idea.
Yeah, but what are the current limitations on the batteries? I mean, how much power could you get out of a battery? How long could they you know kind of pump power out for you?
It's limited by how much money you have.
Aha.
So right now we can buy a lot of lithium ion, but lithium ion batteries, the one that's being constructed by Chugach right now on our campus is 40 megawatts in 2 hours. In other words, it can produce. It can produce or absorb 40 megawatts of power,
mm-hmm.
and it can hold up to 2 hours of duration of producing that level. So that is running about $65 million.
Okay, that's a good metric there. So 2 hours of power, essentially, for $65 million. And I would imagine that if you want a battery that could produce even more length of time of power, it's even more money.
Even more money, but don't forget, there's all different types of both short duration and long duration coming energy, or I'm sorry, type of projects or technologies. So when we are designing the system, we need to take into account all the different characteristics of all the different types of regulation sources, including hydro and our existing thermal. The future long duration energy storage and the short duration fast acting type, and put them in what we call a regulation stack.
Mm-hmm.
So there is not one solution. There are many solutions, and they all have to work together in order to respond to deviations from what we thought the renewable source would do.
So suffice it to say, it's a lot more complicated than just putting up a wind turbine or putting up some solar panels.
Well said. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So speaking of other aspects that need to be in place, we've been hearing a lot in the news, and I know a lot of our members in the robot have talked about upgrades to the transmission system. The federal government has the Department of Energy and the federal government has awarded a grant to the Alaska Energy Authority in order to upgrade the transmission system in anticipation of moving larger quantities of renewables, perhaps, and also redundancy. But can you just talk a little bit about why is it so critical that the rail belt transmission system be upgraded, and what are we trying to go from to? Like, what are we trying to do that's going to upgrade the transmission system?
Let me use the most specific example that we have right now. We have the largest hydroelectric renewable energy source on the grid. Is at Bradley Lake at the very southern tip of the system. That power, that energy that's produced from it, has to get all the way from Bradley Lake all the way to Fairbanks, who is one of the off-takers of that project, mm-hmm. as are all the different railroad utilities. Right now, that plant is rated at 120 megawatts of power that it can produce at any one time. the transmission system will not allow it to accept 120 megawatts. Now you start appreciating how the increase in capacity of transmission, whether it's by upgrading the existing lines or creating new paths, for instance, with the GRIP program, creating a new path to get that capacity transfer up into a different place to get it all the way to Fairbanks. So if we can get that done, especially with the GRIP, what that means is we not only increase the capacity and unconstrain the whole system, but we also allow access in regions like Fairbanks to something, for instance, like tidal. Obviously, tidal doesn't exist in the interior of Alaska. It exists off the east and west forelands of the Kenai Peninsula. If we actually get into this world where we're producing huge amounts of tidal energy, Golden Valley is going to want to benefit from that. And you can't do that with the existing system. You have to upgrade, which means you have to either upgrade the existing or create new paths or both. And that's the whole game. That's what we're trying to accomplish.
It seems to me like you could almost equate the transmission system to a highway, where if you try to put too many cars on a two-lane highway, everything slows down. I know that's not apples to apples comparison, but it's kind of, you think about how things flow, right?
One addition to the analogy is, now let's say that this nice new highway that's been built up since I was a kid, where it was two lanes and no shoulders. Take that nice, four-lane highway that's going to Fairbanks, and now neck it down in one spot down to a one-lane road.
It'd be like a construction site over the summer when you go from four lanes to one lane, right? And everything
is
squeezed.
And we all know what the impact of that is.
Yeah. And it's interesting talking about transmission, because I've been reading a lot about all over the country when they're looking at putting in large-scale renewables, that oftentimes the renewables aren't where the people live necessarily, right? So maybe if you have a wind farm somewhere, it's generally out in maybe the countryside or a very rural part or remote part of the landscape, and that power has to be moved to where the people are. And so talk about that a little bit in terms of, and I think you mentioned it with hydro, but if large-scale solar or wind projects are built in the state, how are we going to move that power from where it is up and down the railroad to make sure everyone can take advantage of it? Is that part of this build out of the grid there?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the latest NREL report that we commented on at our board meeting last night, you're going to find that one of the assumptions that they made, right, wrong, or indifferent, was that they're going to bring on about 1,400 megawatts of wind by 2040. Mm-hmm. And it's the assumptions that were made is that it's all being built either on the Kenai Peninsula or up in the interior with a little bit here in the central area. Well, if that's where the resources are, then you need transmission in order to get that renewable energy to move across the transmission line to where it's needed. The example that we have here at Chugach is the Little Mount Susitna wind project. Mm-hmm. We're openly negotiating with them right now. But if you understand, when you look across and look at Sleeping Lady, that's Mount Susitna. Little Mount Susitna is on the other side of that. Mm. It doesn't seem very far away from eyesight, but that's out in the middle of the wilderness. That increases costs. That makes the cost of renewables a lot more expensive here in Alaska. And don't forget all that regulation stuff, those projects that we talked about, the cost of that has to get added to the cost of the renewable. And that has to meet the requirements of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska that applies what we call an avoided cost standard. So when the utility has to produce one more megawatt hour, what would it cost us to produce that? That has to be compared to the cost of building all these new systems. And the RCA is not going to let us put in a new system that's going to be more than that standard. That is a huge hurdle for us, and that's a very big issue as far as the regulatory challenges related to all of this as well.
And it's probably important to emphasize that the rail belt, so the interior, the Matsu area, the Anchorage area, and the Kenai, receives their power from not-for-profit electric cooperatives. And with the city of Seward having a municipal utility, which is essentially also not for profit, right? And so the members, the ratepayers, are the ones who shoulder these costs because, you know, Chugach Electric Association, for instance, being a cooperative, doesn't have, you know, billionaire investors that are pouring money into the system, right?
By no means. We are a regulated electric cooperative, which means we're a not-for-profit. And being a cooperative, what it means is that any revenues that we get in, what we don't use, get returned back to the membership. We are member-owned, and as are all of the different utilities up and down, save the city of Seward. So the amount of money that we can borrow is pretty good, but also depends on the financial standing of your utility. For instance, right now, Chugach Electric is recovering from the purchase of MLMP.
Right.
So our equity ratio is relatively low compared to historical numbers. We're trying to get that back up. But now we're looking at a major investment going into the future of either buying all these things and trying to make it work, or being put in a position of going the power purchase agreement path, which is what we're doing, in order to spread out those costs by paying somebody else to take that risk.
Yeah, well, if there's one thing I know, and I'm biased because you all are our members, but I've gone to a lot of board meetings all over the state, and one of the biggest concerns, it seems, from the co-op boards is the cost of power, right? They don't want to increase the cost of power so much. While they want to diversify their generation mix, you know, move towards some clean energy resources, but there's still that recognition that the members of the cooperative are the ones who are paying for this, essentially. And so you all are trying to be very good stewards with that money and that cost.
Yeah, one of the issues here is that when we talk about the cost of the new renewable projects, if we sign into long-term PPAs, what that means is that that power purchase is going to last for the term of whatever we agree to, say 20 or 25 years. At the end of it, we don't necessarily own the project, which means we just re-up. And that's a negotiated price. We know that the cost of the project will hopefully be paid down over that period of time and result in a lower power purchase cost because their costs are now down, but you're dealing with a for-profit company.
Yeah.
In the case of, for instance, Bradley Lake, where the community, the state, you know, put in the money to make that happen and make sure that that all the utilities were the off-takers and paying into that and making sure that that project stayed alive, that project is now paid off. And it is now, not back then, it is now one of the cheapest in the state.
Yeah.
So the cost of the renewable has to be taken into account up front. You have to pay that off. And it won't necessarily, I should say, it will offset the fuel savings.
Mm-hmm.
So it will offset the fuel savings in the short term, say 10, 15, 20 years, whatever it takes to pay those off. And at the end of that, maybe our kids will realize that cheaper power when the thing gets paid off. But that's only true if the utilities own it and can realize the sudden drop in our overhead in order to pass that on to our members.
Right. Major long-term investment is what we're talking about.
So, absolutely.
Dustin, and we just have a few minutes left, and I just wanted to know, you think about this every single day. I know you work really hard on it. You know, everyone's moving toward a more clean energy future. What do you think are the steps forward to getting there? What do we need to do to get to a clean energy future?
To me, there's about five different steps, and I wrote them down just to make sure I could convey this well, because I anticipated this. First of all, move forward with plans to decarbonize within each region. Transmission is going to take at least eight years to come true, as far as being able to establish that connection, which means we're not going to wait around for 8 years to make things happen. We need to move ahead, and that's okay. Even the NREL report, Paul Denholm, says each region needs to operate independently, and that's for security, that's for reliability purposes, but translate that into the first step. It's okay to build out our systems regionally, and when I say regionally, I mean the northern region, the central region, the southern region, while we still are focused on increasing the transfer capacity of the system. We need to be doing these at the same time and keep in mind that as we do things regionally, look forward to those opportunities to make sure that we can integrate once that opportunity exists. When that transmission system gets built and we can start trading energy and sharing that energy across that line, mm-hmm. we can't have made systems, for instance, that use completely different equipment or different protocols. They have to integrate at the end of the day. Third thing is to participate in the development of new technologies.
Right.
As I mentioned, we're focused on the high TRL or technical readiness level, things that we can actually buy and implement right now, but we can't let off the gas and we have to participate in the promotion of this technology development. One thing that most people don't may not get for about utilities or the cooperative utilities is that we don't get money recovery from our members for research and development. Mm-hmm. We're kind of at the whim of the industry. We can participate, we can provide information, we can do a lot of things, but we can't necessarily go out and spend $20 million on a demonstration project and hope that it works out.
Right.
The members, the regulatory commission will not approve that type of cost for us. So we have to, but we can't participate. Fourth thing, and this goes to hydroelectric and, you know, these big projects that we were talking about. There's a regulatory hurdle as far as permitting on major projects like this. And that goes for transmission, that goes for hydro. A lot of these really big projects also come with really long lead on permitting. Take the Grant Lake project with Homer Electric. That was something that was a very good project that had very good prospects and took, I can't remember, it's in excess of 10 years just to permit.
Jeez.
So that's an issue that we need to focus on if the utilities are going to get together and do large projects, for instance, on the hydro side. The last thing on my list is to make sure that you understand that once we've built up regionally, once we've made those connections across the regions, that now we have the ability to install those big projects, but also upgrade and scale up on the existing projects that we already built out. So if we follow this path, I think we're going to end up with a few different things. One, we'll set the pace for implementation of these projects right now. We will have tied the system together and opened up opportunities for collaboration. We will have installed the technologies needed to regulate large variable renewable energy. And we will have set ourselves up for success in the future to be able to scale those up and install very large types of renewable energy that will help us out in the future.
Well, that's a lot of work coming in the future. So I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. I wish we could talk for longer, but we're out of time because I think there's a lot of exciting things happening. So we'll have to have you back sometime here in the future to talk about where things stand. So thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of discussion and we're being more collaborative than we ever have been and coming together in order to try to solve these problems. So there's a lot of work being done by a lot of people working on this.
Absolutely. And we see it every day at APA and we're happy to have you all in our membership working toward these goals. So we've been talking to Dustin Hires, the Vice President of Corporate Programs and also the Program Manager for Decarbonization at Chugach Electric Association. This was the Alaska Powerline Podcast. Thanks everyone for joining us and we'll see you on the next episode. Take care now.